Hello and welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host and husband, Kyler K. Jafari.
Good day to you, sir.
Good day, sir. Well, you have prepared yet another fabulous looking concoction for us. What are we drinking today?
Well, actually, this is, you know, we're going to do like Blake Carrington does, and he just goes on a bender and says, we're going to open up just some straight whiskey and drink it out of the glass. So
he loves the brown stuff.
Yeah, and he don't mix anything. So it's a couple ice cubes and a splash of water, but you know, he's opening up the very special bottles because, you know, when he goes on a bender and he's got millionaire money, he's like, I don't care. This is the 35-year-old stuff. We're gonna just waste this on my drunken, you know, rantings tonight. This is a very special selection from Trader Joe's.
I've heard of it. I know him.
Straight whiskey. I think they're billing it as bourbon. It's a little like Maker's Mark, but not even that good. And it's fine. Yeah, I don't know.
It's not as like a, well, it's a little smoky actually. It's not bad. Have I had this before?
I don't think so. I would say this is a good mixing whiskey. Like this would make a nice whiskey sour, mm-hmm. But I think if you're just going to sip something, this is definitely not to sip. But you know, we've doctored it up with a splash of water and a couple of ice cubes and
it's not bad. It's not bad. Now, is bourbon something new to the Trader Joe's portfolio? Because I know they're always
apparently they started doing this a few years ago, but it didn't turn up at our, you know, area Trader Joe's until probably about a year ago, which I think is interesting because we're in the Southern California market. And I feel like, you know, we would have been one of the first guinea pigs for that. Or maybe I just missed it, or just maybe our store didn't have it. I don't know. But I think it's made by the same distillery that does Buffalo Trace, but it's definitely nothing like Buffalo Trace. It's definitely not that quality. I think this is something you serve after you've had your good glass of bourbon, and then you're just like, you want that second one, and by then your taste buds are already fried anyway, so who would know?
That's a great entertaining trick.
I mean, yeah, Jesus always said serve the best wine first.
So. Wow, we're going to be invoking our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on Dynasty As They Want to Be.
Amen.
So what else is going on this week, Kyler, besides trying bourbon
it's interesting.
From Trader Joe's?
We just had this random bushel of raspberries in the fridge, so I'm like, why not garnish this, you know? Oh, by the way, we're drinking it out of the Lismore Crystal. Again, very Dynasty style. We should cheers, by the way.
Oh, we should. Love that sound.
Yeah, so there's a random raspberry in our drinks.
I see.
Which, you know, just reminds me of Raspberry Beret. I can never look at a raspberry and not think about that amazing song by Prince. But also what's more amazing is all of the excellent original recordings that his estate has so kindly released to us. You've never really understood the power of Manic Monday or Glamorous Life, until you've heard Prince's just, I guess they were, I don't think they were demos. I think he just wrote these songs for other people, but then he also had his own original recordings and he just sort of would pick and choose what he decided he wanted to record versus, you know, give to somebody else as a producer. This is just some like amazing, you know, uncovered treasure. And I recommend everybody go out and listen to all of these things that have been released to us now.
Yeah, it's definitely been interesting. You have been wearing down the playlist with all of Prince's unreleased demos this week. I knew that he wrote Manic Monday, but I never knew that he like recorded a full-fledged version himself. And it definitely adds another dimension to this song.
I think
we know
I
really,
like
really well.
His version better.
Of course you do. You're
well,
such a Prince stan.
But here's the thing, like the Bangles definitely took everything he did with that and preserved it. So they thought it was just as good the way it was. I mean, I'm sure in some ways he wrote it that way for them. But the instrumentation is there, the harmonics with the vocals. Oh my God. And I don't know if that's Wendy or Apollonia or I don't know who that is in the background on the vocals, but like it's almost as good as what the Bangles did with it. So I kind of don't even care. You know, it's almost the same song to me and it's Prince doing it, which just makes it that much better in my mind anyway. But
yeah, everybody should definitely go out and listen. Now, are these releases part of like a box set?
No, I think this was actually that album. You know, it's like Prince's new album, quote unquote.
Oh, right.
It's obviously posthumous, but Yeah, and also Glamorous Life, which was, of course, the amazing Sheila E. song. I think there's like some debate if she added like some drum into it that like makes it the song that we know and love. I kind of like this version as well. I don't know if I love it as much as the Sheila E. version, but...
Yeah, that one is definitely a Sheila E. song. It's not a Prince song.
Yeah.
Well, you know what Prince always makes me think of? When I had the audacity before his death to dress up as Prince for Halloween, and it...
Well, but you didn't know it was before his death.
No, of course I didn't. My God, I just love Prince. So I thought, oh, I'll be Prince. And I kind of did this sort of like Purple Rain tour version of Prince where I had this.
It was like Prince in the Revolution years.
It was sort of, I was sort of doing like Prince in the Revolution tour years, but when he was doing like Purple Rain stuff on stage, because he had many like costume changes. So I had this like shiny purple suit with like a pink boa accoutrement on my shoulder.
Lots of diamonds and pearls.
Yeah, I did like a studded diamond pearl shoulder pad.
Don't forget the Cuban heel booties.
But the problem with it was is I don't have the same body type as Prince.
Nobody does. Prince is like the body of Christ. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, quit invoking the Lord in this podcast.
Look, I would die for you. Come on. That's like one of his most amazing songs from that album, by the way.
But I'll never forget we went to New Orleans with some friends for Halloween and I wore my Prince outfit and... You know, it's New Orleans, you're eating and you're drinking a lot, and I just really did not look like Prince. And you made the very...
You probably felt like Prince, though.
I guess I was living my best Prince life, but you made
the... This was the year that I was dressed as David Bowie from Labyrinth as well.
Yeah, we both dressed as Bowie and Prince pre-death, and...
I no longer dress up as people I love anymore because it's a curse. They're all going to die.
We're basically harbingers of celebrity deaths. Mm-mm. So, but you made the startling revelation of what I really looked like.
Yes, I think I said you look like sexy Molière.
Oh, you're very sweet, darling. You said I look like Fat Prince or sexy Molière.
Yeah, well, it's New Orleans, so it kind of doesn't matter. And like, frankly, we were probably the sexiest people on Bourbon Street that night. So,
well, you definitely were. You were getting catcalls all up and down Bourbon Street,
well, you know,
and Royale Street,
you got that
and St.
Dance
Charles
belt and some tights on, doing David Bowie things.
Yeah, so. Well, you pulled it off physically a lot more than I did with my Fat Prince costume. Anyway, the reason it made me think about that, talking about Prince, is this episode, they actually jet off to New Orleans. So I'm really excited. This episode was
so good. It's a little far,
good.
As Crystal says.
Yeah, well, it's a little far for a birthday party.
It's a couple hours in the PJ, but oh, sure, we can do that.
Yeah, so let's take a break and then we'll get into this week's episode. Welcome back. I think we need to just... get straight into this party. A lot of things
happened
in this episode.
It's called the birthday party for a reason.
Yeah, that's the episode title, is the birthday party. And a lot of things happened in this episode. But unlike some of these crazy titles where they tell you like Fallon's wedding and then they don't show you Fallon's wedding, or Crystal's lie and she doesn't really lie about anything, like we actually had a legit amazing birthday party.
This was the best birthday ever, or worse.
So to set it up a little bit, Crystal is feeling a little lonely because Blake has been working a lot, and she suggests that they throw Cecil Colby a birthday party. And Blake is like, are you
not having it?
Like, what are you talking about?
Go away, tramp.
He's like, I'm not gonna throw that guy a birthday party. Like, he
made me marry off my daughter, and also he took advantage of me in a position of weakness to quote unquote save my business, but we all know it's so that he can have a controlling interest in his business.
Right. And Crystal's like, well, it doesn't matter. Let's just have a party.
Well, the other thing,
go to his favorite restaurant in New Orleans.
Yeah, no, the other thing, though, is Blake's not having her either. So he's a little bit annoyed with her on this because, you know, he thinks that she's stepping out on him. And he's like, yeah, you might think that Cecil's my best friend, but in my world, my best friend is just my enemy I keep close to me.
Yeah, I don't think he actually has any best friends.
No.
He doesn't trust his best friends, and now he doesn't trust his wife.
There's a great moment where he's playing pool with the butler, and I love they're playing nine ball, by the way, which is like for serious pool players. Like, that's not screwing around when you play nine ball. Which also kind of like underlies the fact that he quotes this, or doesn't quote, but he references Julius Caesar, which of course is a play all about how the more power you have, the less you can trust the people closest to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very much where Blake is coming from. And he's like, no, I'm not throwing this guy a birthday party, and I don't trust you either, ho.
Right. Well, the reason he doesn't trust her at the moment is because that fucking Michael, the worst chauffeur in the history of chauffeurs, has revealed that she sold the necklace, the emerald necklace. So Blake knows that now. And so he doesn't trust her. He thinks that she's stepping out, which all of this is true. So he's not wrong.
Have we established, though, is she just emotionally in an affair, or have they consummated the affair with Matthew?
I don't think that Matthew Blaisdell's D has been in Crystal Carrington's V, but his T has definitely been down her T. That's tongue and throat. You know, they had that intense makeout session.
Oh, I thought you were referencing train and tunnel.
So it depends on your definition of cheating. Do you think kissing is cheating?
For sure.
Oh, really?
You're right. I guess it's contextual, but I do think emotional cheating is cheating. I do think when you're...
That's the Oprah school.
Yes. I mean, I didn't graduate from her fine college, but I... Do you think that...
I just took continuing courses at Oprah University.
Correspondence course.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to make money? Sure. We all do.
I
don't know. They did smooch in the oil trailer in that episode a while back.
Well, and Crystal doesn't view it as cheating because he straight up says, do you have anything to say?
I love this so much. And she can't say yes or no. He asked, like, have you been faithful to me? He asked the question, brass tacks, and she won't say yes or no. She has cheated on him.
Do I have anything to confess? No. No, I don't.
Well, and she's learning that from Blake because have you noticed anytime anybody confronts him, Michael, his daughter, Crystal, Matthew Blaisdell, anybody on this fucking show, he always responds with a question. Oh, did you have this person beat up? Oh, did I have that person beat up?
And which my mother always taught me was rude, but
answering a question with a question. Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course it is. But that is his go-to defense.
Because he's a negotiator. And in negotiations, you always want the other person to state their starting point first so that you can now argue against that point for something
right.
better.
It's not stupid because it clearly works in all these dum-dums on this show because he gets away with everything. And the thing that I love is that when he responds with a question, he is admitting guilt. Did I have that guy beat up? Did I make sure that the creditors wouldn't give them any money? He's basically saying, I had that guy beat up.
What are you
gonna do
about it?
I made sure the creditors wouldn't give him money.
Evil.
But, you know, every sentence ends with a question mark.
Well, in this case, I think she's, you know, Crystal's finally at a point where she can address that tactic with him. And I just love that she's like, oh, do you mean do I have anything to confess? So she's not going to say yes or no, I'm cheating on you. And she says, no, I have nothing to confess, basically, which is, to me, I took that to mean, like, I'm proud of whatever. I have nothing to hide. I'm not going to confess because, you know, confessing implies that you're hiding something. And she's like, no, I have nothing to confess, which doesn't mean that she's not cheating on him. It just means that she doesn't feel guilty about it.
And one of the reasons I love this episode so much is there's this cat and mouse game with Crystal and Blake. So he knows that she sold the necklace. And then he tells her, well, let's end up throwing this party anyway for Cecil Colby, even though he didn't want to. But make sure you wear that emerald necklace I bought you. And he damn well full knows that that's not the real necklace.
Yeah, the cat and mouse of it all is really sort of like the driving force through this whole episode, really.
Yeah, and Crystal, you can see it in her face because, again, Linda Evans's eye acting. she knows that she's been cornered, and now she has to figure out how she's going to get herself out of this predicament.
Yeah, she's under the gun. She's going to have to come up with some tricks here.
Right, and because Blake says that he wants to sell the necklace because it'll help get the creditors off his back. So she knows that she can't sell this fake necklace.
If this necklace is only worth 40 grand on the pawn market, was that really going to save his corporation?
No, I mean, he even says that any little thing will help. And obviously, it doesn't fucking matter. He's doing it to play a mental game with his wife. So they all board the Carrington private jet to go to New Orleans to Cecil Colby's favorite restaurant.
Which they don't really... like tell you have to kind of figure that out.
Yeah, there's context clues to kind of figure out that they're going to the Big Easy,
to a
French restaurant.
This should be again the birthday party. But you know, this is like how you're talking about how you didn't like that they called it Fallon's wedding and there was no wedding. Well, this is like a birthday party that is totally uncelebratory. I feel like everybody is unwilling. Nobody wants to be at this birthday party. Everybody's having a miserable time. You know, Jeff and Fallon have already had their like bedroom argument about like, you know, he's like, why did you marry me? Like, I really want to know, why did you marry me? And she offers up a lot of like sort of cute excuses, but never really answers. And then she finally like after, you know, by the way, he like grabs her hair and like, it's like, whoa, now Jeff's an asshole.
I know, the domestic violence continues.
Not cool.
It's crazy.
You know, but this is definitely Jeff's episode where he finally gets some cojones.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of get where that's coming from, although it's totally unexcusable. But anyway, and so when he does that, he sort of like extorts this explanation from her. And she finally just says, oh, you want it? Cards on the table. You know, I made a deal with the devil.
Almost immediately, Fallon realizes that she's made a grave error in revealing why they actually got married, and she backtracks.
She does
instantly.
Like the most unconvincing backtrack ever, but okay.
Yeah, he doesn't buy it, and we
it
know
doesn't
he
matter.
Doesn't
yeah,
buy
she's
it,
already but... exposed the lie, and you know he's got that information, and so now you know he's like, oh yeah, okay, I always suspected this anyway. Our marriage is a sham. And so they're totally miserable. You've got Crystal and Blake who are miserable. So you've got all these like very not you know involuntary birthday celebratory things going on this plane, and it should be an exciting time. We're on a plane to New Orleans.
Hell yeah!
But everybody's just sort of like nervously trying to celebrate a birthday, but meanwhile they have all these like nasty things going on in the background. And you know,
but before we get on the private jet, can I just say I love the fact that this scene between Jeff and Fallon is taking place right after Jeff gets out of the shower and he's wearing a baby blue towel dripping wet with like fluffy chest
hair.
Just
admit it, you want to bang him.
I like his body, but I'm not loving his personality or face. But I do like a tall, kind of skinny.
This is Jeff's episode. Like he really, like,
it really is.
He gets balls in this episode, and I appreciate that about this character. We're getting like some real like evolution here,
and we're getting balls too under his towel.
Well, maybe at least they're clean. I also love about this scene with the two of them after she says like, oh, you want to know the goods? Well, how about this? Your uncle and I made a deal and I was sold off to save my dad's company. And like, it's sort of like, you know, record scratch, right? Now that Jeff knows that this is a sham marriage. And then the camera pulls back and you get this great like shot where they're looking at each other in the mirror at her dressing table. So it's like the first time the two of these people see each other in the mirror together. And it's very... quote unquote reflective.
Yeah, I didn't even really think about that, but I love that.
I think there's a lot of those touches in this episode, and you know, oh god, I hated that last episode so hard.
Yeah, it was so disjointed.
I had to go look and like, yes, it was a different director than all the prior episodes, and this is also a different director for this episode, and he's got like all of these interesting things to bring to bear on the storyline. You're getting a lot of those fun details and great moments. And I think it's a well-packaged episode as well.
Oh, yeah. It moves totally quickly. And there's a lot going on. And the blocking is so great in this.
Yes.
So this episode was directed by this guy, Bert.
Brinkerhoff.
Brinkenhoff. Bert Brinkenhoff.
I think the... not the prior director, but the director who did a lot of the other episodes before was Philip Laycock or something.
Yeah, and he did many episodes. But yeah, this director, this episode, getting onto the private jet, did a masterful job of making it seem like that private jet was so big. I'm sure that set is tiny. And there were just many, many different little moments happening on the way to New Orleans. It was kind of comical because, like, in one corner, Andy the lawyer is talking to Crystal. In the other corner, Fallon and Cecil are having a flirtatious moment. And then, like, Jeff sees it. It's like, how big do these people think this plane really fucking
is?
Well,
it is. It's very much like drawing room comedy, but instead of a drawing room, it's a private jet.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. Also, my favorite part of this whole thing is just the tone, because everybody is miserable. Everybody's having a bad time. So they should be on the Mile High Club.
Well, not everybody. So Cecil Colby has brought his little
his
gal
ditzy side
pal.
Piece. Yeah. Yeah,
and she's living it up. She's imbibing,
you know,
a bit
I'm
too
with
much.
Her. I think she's actually taking the point of view of the audience at home. Like, she's having a good time. She don't give a fuck.
She
what
don't
everybody
know what
else
the
is
fuck
to.
Is going on.
And like, she's just pour me another drink.
Yeah, you know? She's here for the PJ of it all.
Very nice, Cecil. Little birthday present for yourself.
That's ultimately your charm, isn't it, Fallon? You always find something nice to say about everybody.
True. Take Miss Bethany now. The innocence of Marie Osmond. The eyes of Grace Kelly. The smile of Goldie Hawn. Does rather look like she was put together out of spare parts, doesn't it?
And I just, yeah, so she's like sort of the exception that proves the rule with everybody else.
I mean, she is an asshat for sure.
Because the rest of these people might as well just be on the Hindenburg. They're not having a good time.
No, I mean, in one corner, you've got Crystal figuring out with Andy how she can like get money to pay for this necklace that she pawned off. In the other corner, you've got Fallon confronting Cecil about his, you know, young side piece. And then they like hold hands and have this kind of loving moment.
And they have this like cheesy as hell shot, like with Jeff seeing like through the screen.
Well, and how moronic do you think that these people are that Jeff isn't going to see it on this, you know, how big would you think it, 50 feet long?
It's a 10 by 20 at most, you know?
Yeah, you don't think everybody's going to see you holding hands in the middle of this damn private jet, but they do it anyway, and that really seals the deal for Jeff. He realizes she was not lying.
He's like, yep, she wasn't.
She really did make a deal with the devil. In this case, the devil is Cecil Colby.
The whole other theme in this episode that gets addressed very quickly when they get to dinner is just the unholy alliances. Think about, and this whole season's been setting this up, think about who's married, who's having an affair, who's in a business partnership. Those two people, whatever we're talking about, are not in a good relationship. And Jeff just does this like savage takedown at the dinner, at, you know, once they get to dinner in New Orleans.
But wait, can we first talk about this restaurant that they went to? Now, obviously, it's a set. They didn't go film on location or anything like that. But this restaurant is absolutely crazy. Well, so they have ceiling fans, and this, you know, to sell the fact that they're in a very humid climate, I guess.
I would never have gotten that this is in New Orleans, because we've been to our fair share of restaurants in New Orleans, and, you know, this just...
Yeah, this doesn't look like anything we've ever been to. It's definitely like a Hollywood set decorator's New Orleans fantasy. But I just love that the ceiling fans are so low that it looks like if John James gets too close, he's going to lose his head.
Or at least, you know, the 3 inches of moose hair on top.
And yeah, I mean, like you're saying, everybody's having a miserable time and the actors are totally selling
it. Well, again, this is part of like the great directing in here. I think this is some of the best performances we've gotten as an ensemble, you know, like the cast is really vibing with each other. And like, I'm getting like super performances from everybody.
No, this is right up there with some of those great filmic kind of dinner party scenes, discreet charm of the bourgeoisie.
Yeah, you're right. Well, you're sort of getting at the corruption of the upper middle class, like sort of being exposed at the dinner table. I don't know why that's always like such a good device, but it's working here for sure. And I can't get enough of Jeff's like savage takedown of everybody.
Yeah. You know, so he basically spends the whole dinner dancing with Bethany, Cecil Colby's young sidekick.
Well, that's his first trick. He's like, that's what Jeff's like doing here. He's like, this is very like George from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He's going to like pick a guest and just play a game. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he's going to pull out Cecil's ditzy side piece. And he's like, oh, I know her weakness. She's just going to get drunk and make a fool of herself in front of everybody and make Cecil look stupid too. So he does that. So that's the first one. And then the other one is when he just sort of like exposes everybody's lies at the table. And then he like picks up Fallon at the end and just walks out, you know, like my damage is done. Bye y'all. I mean, he's like total nihilist in this and I just love it.
Well, it's kind of like, you know how on The Real Housewives, you kind of live for one scene every season is like a crazy dinner party where the women come out and they expose the lies, they expose what's going on, probably because the producers told them to. But that's basically
usually a table gets flipped.
Yeah, well, not usually, but when it does, that's amazing.
Somebody winds up with their top off. Yeah.
Hopefully. No, this really is among those great nasty dinner party scenes. And
well, no, the other thing, like part of Jeff's savage takedown is he even references the emerald studded.
He saves the best for last.
Are you quite finished, Jeff?
Not quite. The one I think we really ought to drink to is Crystal. Well, she married into this emerald studded zoo of ours without any preparation at all. And who knows what price she's going to pay for it. To you, Crystal. Good luck, kid. You're going to need it.
And he's right. This is a zoo, and I love that comparison. And like Crystal, like clutches her emeralds, which she should be clutching her pearls. But you know, Blake wouldn't let her wear those.
Is that the next level of clutching your pearls? Is clutching, yes, clutching your emeralds? Oh my God! Oh, okay, we need to make level. That happen.
Yeah,
I'm all run clutching out my emeralds. Yeah, and Blake tells Fallon to go take care of
go
that.
Go take care of that. And she's like, she's your wife. He said he's your husband, because he's like, you got to fix this Jeff guy. He's fucking this party up.
Blake takes the strategy of retreating. He doesn't engage in this.
Oh, no. I don't think he's retreating. I think this is classic power moves again. Like, use other people to get things done. Don't do them yourself, because then when it comes back, it's not on you.
But he doesn't engage with Jeff. He doesn't. Nope. He doesn't go out at all. And he sends Fallon out.
Oh, no, this is
out.
Child's play. For him, like, he's like, I've dealt with much worse than you guys. Like, so he just sits back and like lets Jeff do his thing.
That's true. I think he's probably thinking like 3 or 4 steps ahead. He's not thinking about what's actually happening at this New Orleans.
No, Jeff's going
party.
For the easy target at this point. But I don't blame him. And like, it's nice to see like Jeff not just be a himbo for once. And
right. Well, he's obviously been surrounded by this sort of maniacal behavior. So he kind of knows it, but he's not, you can tell he's not well experienced in the game, certainly not as much as Blake and Cecil are. So yes, it's great that he goes for it, but he could use a bit more refinement in his strategy
maybe. But it makes for great television, so
definitely
part of the unholy alliances. You know, you've got Jeff and Fallon, which is clearly like a deal with the devil, but then you've also got Fallon going out to Crystal after, you know, she runs off clutching her emeralds, and she's like, look, I don't know if my dad knows, but definitely Michael knows, and I know,
yeah.
And, you know, Crystal's like, you know, obviously like anxious about this whole situation.
Yeah, she needs help anywhere she can get it.
Right. And so now she's going to have to turn to Fallon, and Fallon's like, well, look, I can help you out with the money. I can't do anything about that necklace that you got to get back, but I can at least help you with the money. And Crystal, it's funny because Fallon was telling Jeff that she married him because they're orphans. Here she's telling Crystal that she can help her out and they're both thieves, you know, honor among thieves or whatever. So there's all these like unholy alliances going on with all of these different characters, which I love. And I don't know that Crystal's really going to take her up on that offer, but
I don't think Crystal has any choice at this point.
No, she's any port in the storm right now.
Like, but it also doesn't matter because Blake knows and he's in the power position. So she can do everything she can, but basically the hemorrhaging is happening.
This is again part of why I just love Fallon so much. She's like my favorite character on the show other than Claudia. And she's clearly got her own interests, you know, at heart, but she's still trying to fix this thing with Crystal again for her own reasons. She later goes and like has that like limo moment with Matthew. And of course he's like, he's too good for all of that. He's not going to help her or anything, but she does do that classic like rich snob thing, which is like, I don't want this woman to be part of my family. Will you just buy her off? You know, like I'll pay you money to take her away.
Right. Well, that's, she's not doing any of this out of the goodness of her heart. So she goes to Matthew Blaisdell to get him to pay Crystal back because this whole necklace thing came about because she wanted to loan him.
Yeah. And she's
money.
Like, and Fallon's like, look, if I just pay you this money, will you take her off my hands so that, you know, my father can move on?
Right. That's what she wants out of it. She wants Crystal gone because that's coming just, between her and daddy.
That's just like that old fashioned, like, I don't want you as part of my family. Like, what do I have to pay to like buy you off? Cause you're not good enough for our aristocratic.
Right.
You know?
Well, because if Crystal's not around, then Fallon is going to be head bitch in charge. Mm-hmm. And that's what Fallon wants. Matthew doesn't want any part of it. He's like, pull over, get me out. This is stupid. I'm not going to help you, Fallon. Which I don't even know if they've ever even spoken before in the show. So it's kind of interesting.
It's an interesting pairing. Again, very dramatic
scene in the back of a limo. I don't know totally what he's thinking, but it does kind of work because Matthew meets up with Crystal at the weirdest fucking cafe I've ever seen in my life that has blocked out windows.
Phil's Cafe.
Yeah. The exterior shot clearly shows windows, but when you go inside, they've blocked everything out.
The best part, well, they do some of that like, I don't know, like local color, like in the very, very like beginning of that scene where the guy's like paying his tab to leave, or not tab, he's like, he's paying for his bill because he ordered breakfast. And then like, and then you, the camera pans over to Crystal and she's wearing this like impeccable white suit with, you know, a very sharp, you know, teal colored blouse underneath, and she's in Phil's Cafe, and it's like all these like podunks and hicks and stuff like at like some low rent restaurant location.
I think what happened is the set decorator spent all of their budget on the New Orleans restaurant, so they didn't have any money for Phil's Cafe.
Well, I just love the image of Crystal in all of her finery and like what's basically like a Waffle House.
Moon's over my hammy. So she gets her money back. Matthew Blaisdell presents her with an accordion file filled with 100.
Well, it's a totally anachronistic, out of context comparison, but I got like serious like Winkies from Mulholland Drive vibes, like, because he's like, you know, when the deal is done, then he's like, here's the money, and it just gets passed over the table at the diner, and she's like, what's this? And he's like, open it and find out, you know?
Yeah, and there's nothing romantic about it at all. No. No kissing, no fingering under the table.
No money under the table.
So after she gets the money, then she goes back to the Carrington mansion, and Blake is getting lit, as we alluded to earlier, on 35-year-old bourbon.
I think he's an alcoholic.
You think?
Listen, if you or somebody you know has a problem with alcohol, please seek help.
Well, but not Blake Carrington, because it actually provides for fodder for this podcast. So please keep drinking. But
pour me another bourbon.
But basically, he wants her to prove her love to him.
Do you love me, Crystal?
Of course I do.
As much as I love you?
Yes.
More than any man that you've ever known?
Yes.
Well, then show me. Show me how much you love me now.
Blake.
Show me.
I know that you love subtext and reading things into things, and I'm kind of a perv, as people have probably noticed from listening to this podcast. During this scene where Blake and Crystal were kind of talking about their relationship, I was getting BDSM vibes. I think that Blake is a dom and Crystal's a sub, and she really likes being in that position. Like, she's getting off on him saying, show me how you love me, prove it to me, get on all fours.
I think that's an excuse based in postmodern misogyny. I think that she's got classic Stockholm syndrome, and this is all of the problems that second wave feminism was trying to deal with. And it's all expressed through like Blake, who's this like tycoon, so he can get away with everything. So he's like the ultimate masculine overbearing power.
And I don't know. I think she kind of likes it. I'm getting like a 50 Shades situation going on.
What points at her liking it?
It's all in those eyes. Like when he was telling her, prove to me that you love me, show me, she kind of lit up a little bit. You didn't notice that?
If she lit up, she would have opened her robe and showed him.
Well, not in 1981 on ABC, darling.
Well, also, it's Crystal. She's not like that. Crystal's like a lady, and she ain't going to show the goods just because he tells her to.
Lady on the streets, freak in the Carrington mansion.
Well, the only one that's really freaky is Blake. Again, he's like turning to like, I'm pissed off and I can't trust anybody and all you people are assholes. So I'm just going to open up some expensive bourbon for no good reason other than I just want to get drunk. And he walks off. And you don't know if he took that bottle with him or if he left that bottle on the coffee table. So again, great directing. I don't know.
I think the three of them went back to the bedroom together. Blake Carrington, Crystal Carrington, and the bottle.
Okay.
Crystal and Blake. Now, one person that we have not talked about at all in this episode is Lindsay Blaisdell. Just kidding. She's not in it. Thank God. No, Stephen Carrington. He had a major B plot going on here. Now, he wasn't part of the dinner party.
A B plus plot.
He didn't go to New Orleans, but he did have a lot going on in his personal life. So the episode actually started with him hosting a little dinner party with him and his sister and Jeff.
That's so sweet.
It was very sweet. I love it when we get those little moments with Stephen and Fallon. They really are...
In a weird way, they are the heart of the show.
They're like literally the only people that actually like each other.
They're the only two people in this family, yeah, that don't have an unholy alliance.
Yeah, and they talk about their love for their father, but I don't believe any of them. Like, I'm pretty sure they both hate their father and realize what a fucking monster he is.
That's why Steven even says to her in that scene, like, you know, I love him as much as you love him. Which is it's sort of like Crystal's way of saying, I don't have anything to confess.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same like
saying without
saying.
How do
we like dance around this and say it, you know?
Yeah.
Like neither of us really loves him, so you love him as much as I do. You know?
So Fallon gets some like sauce or something on her blouse, and then she has to go change into one of Steven's shirts, and then she notices in the closet. I swear, anytime anybody goes in a closet on this show, secrets
are revealed.
Birth
control 90.
And now just, you know, sex 90. And I think what's interesting is she finds it and then she realizes that Stephen has had relations with a woman. But like, why didn't she think like, Stephen like to wear 90s?
I like that they didn't go down the old road of every gay man secretly wants to cross dress. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of didn't like that they'd go down that road. I wanted it to come up.
You wanted that quaint comedy of Stephen in a 90.
Yeah. I mean, at least as a throwaway joke, like, Stephen, do you like wearing this 90? But no, it's obviously Claudia Blaisdell's 90. She left it over there after some hot sex with Stephen Carrington.
Which, again, she must be a sex goddess because that's one skimpy little nighty. And even Jeff is like, yow, when he walks in the door and sees Stephen holding this nighty.
I know, that was so funny. So they have a cute conversation, and that's where it comes up where Fallon and Jeff are at an impasse in their relationship.
It's nothing.
Don't give me that, Jeff. I may have flunked a few courses at Miss Porter's, but I always got a B+ on my beef bourguignon.
Okay, you asked, I'll tell you. It's Louisiana.
What about Louisiana?
I found out today why I didn't get the transfer there. It seems your father had a little something to do with the decision.
Morvino?
Jeff is putting all of the pieces together, and he has the picture now.
But this whole thing with Steven to me is about like his apartment, you know, like he's moved out. We already complained about like his unusual decorating in his room at the Carrington Mansion. And now he's like full blown decorating at the 80s condo or whatever this apartment is.
Yeah. I mean, we got a little peek at the bedroom when Lindsay was snooping around and he was banging Claudia. But I have to say, I'm not super impressed with his apartment. I thought it would be bigger.
I mean, it is an apartment and he's humble. You know, he's like he's trying to start out from the beginning. So I get that. But
it does have exposed brick.
There are some nice touches, though. There's the exposed brick, which every gay man in the 80s loved.
And in the 80s, honey, well, every gay man
it's now a timeless classic, but we didn't know back then. It was like track lighting, you know, as they say in Steel Magnolias. But also they've got that nice Burlwood Parsons dining table.
Yeah, I love the dining table.
That, you know, so there are some like these touches of like late century modernism that you're seeing. And there's also like that Jetsons fireplace that I feel like was always a prize on Price is Right at this time.
Well, Fallon really wants Stephen to reveal his relationship with a woman to Blake Carrington. And I love Stephen's forward thinking, sexual positive vibe that he doesn't need to prove anything to his father. What does it matter whether he's in a relationship with a woman or likes a woman?
That's actually
not
a very refreshing and still contemporary idea. And it's later reiterated when Ted shows up at the oil field.
Yeah. So that's how the episode
ultimate
ends.
Stalker, you know, like, and I love that, Steven's like, are you here on business, Ted? And Ted's like, no, I'm not here on business. I'm here to see you. But
he
it's
basically
like,
got laid off, I guess.
I don't
and
know.
Use that as an excuse.
He may not
to
be there on
Denver.
Business, but he's definitely got an agenda because he's like, oh, give me your address and I'll have a pizza and red wine feast waiting for you at your apartment.
Yeah.
And that's
I mean,
a little bit stalkery.
You were kind of trying to sell me on this whole Ted Dinard as a stalker thing before. And I do wonder, because you know, you've seen these episodes, so you have some...
I'm clairvoyant.
You have some gay clairvoyancy with it, but I'm starting to feel that vibe now. Ted is pushing too hard. And Stephen reveals to Ted that he's in a relationship with a woman, and a married woman at that. And Ted's kind of unfazed by it. He's like... Okay, really? Well, can we at least have dinner?
That was
and
old
fuck
hat
tonight?
At that time. It was like, oh, you're gonna go straight now. I mean, it was all those societal pressures to just find a woman
I guess
and make
I forgot
it work.
About that.
Which is basically Blake's attitude the whole show. So
yeah, I guess I forgot about that. I would think that Ted would be a little bit more evolved, but he doesn't care. He just wants to order a pizza and bang the shit out of Stephen Carrington. So.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely sort of like trying to sanitize their relationship. It's like, but he didn't fly all the way out here for pizza and red wine. Come on.
Anyway, Stephen goes along with it and invites Ted over for din-din and drinks. Well, and they play a little fun literary game. Are you familiar with this game they were playing?
No, this is just more of the Shapiro's like literary, you know, pretensions. Like, this is English major mutual masturbation. This is like,
definitely.
Let's just throw Ben Jonson quotes back and forth at each other. And poor Al Crowley, like having to like recite bad French. I mean, I don't think it was the character. I think it was just he couldn't chew on that line very well, but that's fine, whatever.
Yeah, clearly he was not an expert en français. Well, this little game was making both of them horny for each other because Ted said, can I stay here tonight? And Stephen was like, mm-hmm. So, again, I think this is a bisexual journey for Stephen Carrington.
Maybe, maybe not. I
know that probably wasn't the intention, but that's what I'm getting from it. Like, he is swinging both ways, back and forth.
Well, okay, yeah, that's totally valid. I think this is more unholy alliances. I think the two of them are totally bad for each other. And that's even pointed out when they're quoting each other, or quoting this, you know, doing this game of quotes back and forth with fire versus rain. So, you know, I don't think it's going to work out in the end, but it's interesting.
No, it's not going to work out because he has these two people that he's juggling, and Ted at this point doesn't seem like he wants to go anywhere except for Stephen Carrington's king-size bed in his new apartment.
But the final thing I take away from Stephen and Ted in Stephen's apartment that night is, you know, they are throwing these quotes back and forth, playing this game. And it's fire and rain. And the two of them are not going to work out. And they are another unholy alliance. Like, it's just something that's not meant for the two of them to work out.
I don't know how it's going to end, but it's not going to end well. You can just feel that.
Well, how it ends in this episode is the thunder and rain cuts to the jeweler's, you know, hawking agency.
Yeah, now that Crystal got that money from Matthew Blaisdell, she wanted to get her necklace back. But, honey, that's in South America now. So, rut-row, what she's going to do
yeah,
now.
Yeah, he's like, sorry, somebody bought that. I didn't think you were coming for it. And he's in South America, so you can kiss that necklace goodbye. I guess we'll see.
It doesn't matter because everybody in fucking Denver knows that she hawked this necklace. It's not a secret anymore. So this doesn't really end on a hugely dramatic note for me. Do you think Crystal is going to get out of this? I mean, you know, but...
Here's the thing. I don't remember. There's a couple moments in this whole show that in my memory, maybe they align with what's about to happen, but maybe they're from a different plot point. I just know if I was in Crystal's position, I'd be like, get me a fucking plane to South America.
Oh, shit. You think we're going to go to South America in the next episode? I mean, we did go to New Orleans in this one, so who knows? Anything's possible. Anyway, that's it for this episode, The Birthday Party. Let's take a break.
This was just one of my favorite episodes.
I loved it. I loved every second of it. I was riveted.
You can watch this in a vacuum and just enjoy this, and just this is a work of art all on its own.
Yes, listeners, if you have friends out there and you want to get them on board with watching old episodes of a 1980s soap opera, dial this one up. I think it's a good case study of who the characters are, who the players are, the game. They can kind of wrap their heads around it, and it's sudsy and it's juicy. The production values are pretty good. Yeah. This is a good episode to kind of get a nice slice of early dynasty. Yeah, I hope they do too. He did a good job. Anyway, let's take a break and talk about our lurks of the week.
Oh my God, yes.
Now, in case you're a new listener, this is a segment where Kyler and I each pick out our favorite ensemble from the episode and discuss why we liked it. Because dynasty is as much about fashion as it is about a family fucking each other over. Kyler, what was your favorite look of the week?
I picked out something that just every time... We've watched this episode a few times now, and I keep forgetting this, and then I see it, and I'm like, oh yes, that's just amazing. And it's Crystal's solo dinner outfit at the beginning of the episode, and she just kind of walks into the library, and it's this like super sharp, you know, like razor sharp black dinner suit or evening suit, and it's probably like a silk fiber. I don't know if it's like a crepe de chine or something like that, but anyway, it's got nice shoulders. It's a nice, it's just, I don't know, it's almost classic, but it's got a little bit of a low cut. It's, you know, formed at the waist, and it's just, it's very Crystal.
It is,
but it's also a little bit like power Crystal. It's not soft Crystal. You know, so I just really like this look, and it's very evening, and it's almost like I don't think she would wear this, but then I see her in it, and it's like, oh, this is very much her look, you know?
I also chose a Crystal look. This one came at the end of the episode. Yours was at the beginning, but it's when she shows up to meet up with Matthew Blaisdell at Phil's Cafe, and she's wearing like a really kind of like powerful white suit with a teal shirt. She's got the collar popped out of it and got a nice like metallic belt with it. It's like the day version of what your look of the week is.
Well, I think it's part of what makes this scene so amusing too, because like she's like way overdressed for Phil's Cafe.
Oh yeah. And I mean, that's what they're trying to get across, right? Absolutely. Like this is some cafe where oil derrick workers go. And yeah, I don't know. It seemed a little forward thinking. We're getting some big shoulder pad. I know we keep talking about the evolution of the shoulder pad, but I like the color. I think we haven't really seen her in a lot of light colors. Like sometimes we see her in
green is the blonde's color,
earth color, so. Earth tones. But yeah, green, it really brings out her eyes, and the white really makes her beautiful blonde hair pop. I don't know. It's very different, and it's very like Tony Montana from Scarface. Like it's kind of this
might have come off the runway from Claude Montana. So that all kind of works out in a weird way.
Who is she?
Claude Montana, one of the greatest like designers of the like early to middle 1980s.
Not familiar.
All right. Well, go check out a fashion show on YouTube and get back to me.
All right. I'm going to go Google that right now. Well, that's it for another episode of Dynasty As They Want to Be. Kyler, I want to thank you for joining me, along with DJ Jugo for composing our theme song, and the artist Lindsay Mound for designing our graphics, which you can find on our social media, which is at Nasty, N-A-S-T-Y, podcast, and nastypodcast.com. You guys, we've been making over 10 episodes of this, so if you're along with us for the journey, go ahead and leave a review, a 5-star review on
iTunes. We all have an opinion.
Yeah, leave an opinion. If you don't like the podcast, why are you listening to the end of it? Don't leave a review. Just quit listening. Go do something else with your life. But if you're a fan, if you love it, tell others. Tell your friends. Tell people on iTunes or other fine podcast
tell your
providers.
Wife, tell your friends.
All right. We'll see you guys next week for the episode. What's it titled, Kyler?
The next episode?
Yeah, of Dynasty, what this
Shit,
podcast is
know.
About. All right. Well, next week we'll figure out what the episode title is. We'll watch it and we'll talk about it. Hope you guys have a great week. We'll see you then.
Happy birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday.